You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and this is the Comedian's Comedian podcast. Today it may or may not be a non-com pod rather than a com-com pod. My guest is not technically a comedian and besides I'm trying to sort of play with a bit of a strand. I'm playing with a strand, guys. That's just the kind of online pseudo-marketing babble I'm doing. What I've been considering, as some of you may know, what a lovely glottal stop that was. What I have been considering. Back to Coventry in the mid-90s for me. I am considering doing these podcasts, basically tweaking slightly what I do in order that I can do less research and have more fun, think about it less, get less kind of, friction, mental friction. If you want to listen to the insiders extras from this episode, you'll hear me and Helen talking about my kind of pre-interview research trauma and how it sometimes stops me from getting guests who have done an enormous volume of work. So what I thought was that during the Panny D, or the Pando, as I believe Mark Watson is calling it, that's catching on in our household too, during the Panny D, I thought that rather than chase down comedian guests, watch them live, do loads of comedy research, I will instead focus on people whose output I know, some people who aren't necessarily comedians, but also do a slightly different version of a ComCom because I can't see people live and I don't really have time during the Great Pivot to be sitting and watching the normal amount of Netflix specials and so on that I normally would. I want the show to remain expansive and well-researched and all of those things that you love about it, I hope. So I am trying to do this new version. There we go. That's 2 minutes of absolute guff as I try to explain what I'm doing. And as we will discover in next week's episode with Brett Goldstein, the idea of a non-com pod doesn't really exist. I am what I am and I have the conversations that I have. So please enjoy this one of them with the brilliant Helen Zaltzman, who is was an early kind of podcast mentor of mine. We did some of those Can I Buy You a Coffee and Pick Your Brains chats back when she was available for that. She is now in the world of podcasting one of the most highly targeted people along those lines. She created the Podcasters Support Group, which I would always recommend you go and check out if during the Panny D you are considering starting a podcast. It's absolutely worth its weight in gold simply to spend a day searching through the feed on that page and seeing the sorts of issues that come up time and time and time and time and time and time again, and before then contacting your friends who do podcasts such as me and asking penetrating well-researched questions which will get far better responses. But listen, she's not just the podcast queen, even though 14 years ago with Ollie Mann she started producing Answer Me This, which has been brilliant since then. She is also now the host of the Illusionist podcast on the Radiotopia Network, and we're going to talk about that, the name, the use of language, how she started off in comedy via a connection to Josie Long, how she managed to work out what it is that she does in a very, very open playing field by being really honest with herself about what her parameters for success really were. I loved this conversation, and this and future episodes that I'm recording during the pandemic were and will be streamed live at twitch.tv/Stu Goldsmith. So you can get over to twitch.tv/Stu Goldsmith at 1 p.m. on Wednesdays going forward, and you can watch my head and the head of my interviewee live as we have a nice chat with each other. Thank you so much to the 50 or so people who turned up to the Brett Goldstein recording yesterday. That episode will go out on Thursday next week. So that's the plan. We record on a Wednesday at 1, and then the episode goes out in a trimmed and edited podcast form on this feed the following Thursday, but not the directly following Thursday, a week later. This is barely worth getting into. I'm just feeling exuberant because I'm excited to bring you this episode with the wonderful Helen Zaltzman. Do you find when people interview you, as someone who interviews a lot of people or has interviewed a lot of people, do you find that you make their lives easier? Or that you, like, I take over, I start running the interview in the middle of being interviewed in a way that I hope is charming, but I just can't, like, I can't help but leave little breaks and saying, oh, you could put an edit in here, and do you know what I mean? That's it, the most awful backseat driver interviewee. Do you do that, or are you a better interviewee?
Hopefully I do things like, if I mess up a sentence, I go back to the sentence and start it again, so it's easier for whoever's editing it. And then if I listen to it and they haven't edited it, I'm pretty pissed off. But sometimes I'm interviewed by, say, a student who sounds really, really nervous because they're quite new. And yeah. I just try to put them at ease, and they might not be very good yet, but they're learning. So I just try and give them material that they can do something with.
Yes. Do you ever say great question when it hasn't been a great question?
In life, tons. I'm used to getting questions because of Answer Me This. I'm used to getting a lot of questions that are so much worse than anything the average human mind could imagine.
Yes.
And in volume.
Well, this is beautifully, you've structured this very neatly. So I think we should set you up by, I'm trying to work out how we came across one another, because at the time you started making the podcast Answer Me This with Ollie Mann. Mm. When? I mean, it must be 10 years ago. It must be more than 10
more.
Years.
Yeah, it was January 2007 we started. So I knew you because around that time and a bit earlier, I had helped Josie Long with her comedy club, the Sunday Night Adventure Club, which you had played. Yes. I think there was one memorable bit where you jumped into a pair of shorts.
Oh, I jumped into a pair of pants, actually. Yes, I just think they probably looked like shorts because I was already wearing pants. Because in my room, I would have done it without wearing pants. But obviously, you can't really do that at a Josie Long gig, certainly.
Well, it's quite a small venue and you might all feel a little bit too personal. So I knew you from that. And then you very kindly came along to provide vocals for various jingles and things.
Did some jingles and stings for you, yes. I remember the only one I remember was being a Cenobite from Clive Barker's Hellraiser. I remember that more than I remember the jumping into the pants incident. That seems like something I'd have done.
I need to dig out that Cenobite one. There's one as well where you play aromatherapy and you go, Helen and Ollie, smell me. It's a very convincing performance. Don't know if you've got in your spotlight profile.
So who were you prior to that? How did you get into working with Josie, and how did you get into, which came first, working with Josie or podcasting?
Well, I knew Josie, we were overlapped at university, and I remember meeting her in Edinburgh 2001, where I was doing some plays and she was doing stand-up. She was 19 at the time, which was really young. And there are more young stand-ups now than there were then, but she'd been doing stand-up since she was like 14. And I bumped into her a few times and I think she was really lonely and having quite a difficult time, but I didn't really know her then. And I was also kind of in awe of her as this 19-year-old stand-up. And then I think when we were back at university, I invited her on my student radio show. She'd sent me this very, very sweet letter. I kind of hope she's forgotten this, but also that she doesn't mind me bringing it up. After Edinburgh, she sent me this really sweet letter, which was her going, in which she thought I was called Catherine, and a lot of the letter was about whether she'd spelt Catherine right. It was so cute. I hope I've still got it somewhere in my museum. So yeah, I'd known her since then, and we'd sort of hung out a lot. And at the time the club started, we were living very nearby, and we used to hang out a lot because both of us were underemployed. We used to play Boggle a lot, do a bit of crafting. And she said she was going to do this comedy club, and I volunteered to make props and stuff because I like making things. But I think my creative self was sort of dormant at the time. I think when you're a child, you spend a lot of time making things, and then you don't necessarily realize that you have to actively keep that up if that's part of you. When you're an adult, you have to create the reasons to do those things. And I remember going to one of those pottery painting cafes for my husband's birthday, because he loves that. And one of our friends, Alex, who's a very creative person, but in a very different career path, there was something unleashed in him by painting this teacup. because it had been such a long time since he had occasion to paint anything. So I was very lucky to know Josie, who just did stuff. She will just have ideas and do things with them, which was very inspiring to me because I don't like doing anything unless I have to, unless there's a deadline or something. So, yeah, I started doing things like that with her, and we would do all these decorations each month because the club was themed, and try and think of silly little funny things to do. And there was also a time where she was doing a run at the Soho Theatre, I think that was early in the podcast, for one of her Edinburgh shows, and it was a 12-night run, and each night I would sit on stage embroidering a scene from her show. So that's the kind of shit that we used to do
back
then.
That we used to do before YouTube. I mean, because...
Well, YouTube was founded in 2005, so...
I know that. That's one of the few things I know. I got it wrong in a quiz once, and ever since it's burned on my brain. I remember very few dates, but I can certainly tell you YouTube was formed in 2005. But you were... but obviously, the internet existed, but it will be unexplainable to children of the future the extent to which the internet only just existed. Like, you were podcasting, and obviously you have been through even longer than I have of having to explain the time when you had to explain to people what a podcast was. Did you have to explain to people what the internet was?
Well, it was borderline. I think Britain also was a few years behind the States in podcasting and also internet, because I had friends who were very online in the 90s, which I certainly wasn't. I wasn't really very online until like 2003. Later. And also, just when I started podcasting, the iPhone wasn't out yet. So certain internet-y things like making a video of yourself and uploading it was just a lot more of a hassle then. And getting podcasts was a real pain because you had to connect an old-fashioned iPod to a computer. So I didn't listen to things. So I didn't have an iPod. So technologically, things have come a long way. And having to convince someone that they might like to find entertainment on the internet isn't such a battle anymore.
Yeah, right. Because at one point you would have to say, no, I mean, even recently, a few years ago, pre-serial. And I mean, I don't know which podcast festival it was, but I remember seeing someone's branding was, I think the branding of the festival was, I was listening to podcasts before serial. But that was like such a kind of a seismic kind of moment where we've both had to say to people, it's downloadable internet radio or whatever is your sort of, your thing. It's great, crazy. We'll get on to the podcasty bit. But you were... working let's just put a little pause in this for a second. Who were you at and before university, before you met Josie? What did you study at uni? I guess it was classics or English or something.
It was sort of a combination of both, because it was old and middle English, so English up to 1400, and it was a brilliant pragmatic choice because there's less of it. Like, once you start getting into Shakespeare, you really fucked yourself, because A, lots to read. B, lots written about it that you have to read. C, there's nothing original you can say. Nothing. Nothing. So you're not going to get a very good mark. Whereas before 1400, the stuff really cuts to the chase, which I found interesting. And there's not as much written material. So it gives you time to pursue your extracurriculars. So I felt like I really... a lot of the stuff that I did when I should have been... studying, or why I wasn't studying Shakespeare because I didn't have to, those were more useful in life than the actual academics. But also, I wasn't expecting the old and middle English to be useful, because at the time I went to university, you could go for free and study something because you were interested in it and to form yourself as a person and not expect to have to find some use out of it. And then 12 years later, it did become useful. But that was impossible to plan.
Yeah. Isn't that like, that's one of those things where I suppose we realise how old we are. I realise how old I am.
Old Stuart Goldsmith.
I kind of hear myself, as well as someone like yourself, saying things like, well, of course, in those days. But like, or like in the way that, for example, I will hear comedians often say, well, of course, in the 80s, you could just be on the dole and be a comedian. Yeah. Like, you could just, that was a legit thing. You were eligible for payment from the government if you were like, I'm being a comedian. They'd be like, sure, there's your money. And in a similar way, now we can look back at university and go, oh, you used to just go to university to grow as a person rather than to train vocationally or just to smash pints. So it's a...
It's an incredible privilege, and everyone should have it. Then it wouldn't be a privilege. It would just be something everyone could have. But I appreciate how lucky I was.
I'm going to put a pin in a question for later on. As the creator and host of the Illusionist podcast, do you have to really stay on yourself and pick yourself up on little linguistic things like that in case people get in touch with you and say things like, it can't be a privilege if everyone has it, because your fan base are the sort of people that pick up on that kind
of
shit.
Yeah, they are terrible assholes.
Regularly hoist
lovely,
you with your
lovely,
own
terrible assholes. There are certain words that I look up in the dictionary just to protect myself, because they respect the dictionary. So I remember I did this episode, and before throwing to an ad, I say, we'll be back momentarily or something. And I thought, I'll just check that momentarily means coming up in a moment, essentially. Yeah. And I got like dozens of people getting in touch complaining about it, and I had to go, look, it's in the fucking dictionary. And that's the one thing you took away from this episode.
Yes. Yes, yeah. We'll get onto this shortly, but just while we're on it, I believe the word irregardless. Do you know about the word irregardless?
Oh, yes.
So
yes.
It's a completely torturous fuck together, a torturous fuckstorm of regardless and irrespective. But I believe it is now so commonly misused that it is in the dictionary in the same way as literally now just means emphatically.
It's a very valuable learning experience. Literally used to really needle me. But I've just had to learn to tolerate it, because it's a linguistic process that happens all the time. There's a brilliant book called Word by Word by Corey Stamper, who worked at the Merriam-Webster Dictionary for 20 years. And there's a whole chapter about irregardless there, because obviously it's a nonsense word. But if a word is used in a sustained fashion, then it becomes a word. I mean, they're all from nothing. They're all just from grunts.
I mean, that's a great point. And they're all from grunts.
And the sooner that you can kind of relinquish the urge to be angry about it all the time, the happier you'll be. This is something that I have found since doing a podcast about linguistics and stuff.
We'll come on to that soon. But let's go back to pre-university then. What kind of kid were you?
I was just really waiting to be an adult. I just really wanted to be an adult, and not in that I was trying on high heels or something, or like smoking when I was 8. I didn't do any of that stuff. I just wanted to not be noticed and then be able to be an adult, because I think it represented freedom to me. And also because I was the youngest in the household, because I was an accident baby. And therefore, because of the age gap, I felt kind of vulnerable, because everyone else knows stuff and you don't, and not knowing stuff is a weakness and can be used against you. So I think I wanted to be independent very early on, before it's really practical to be so. I wouldn't accept help, though. And I don't feel nostalgic about childhood. I don't think back at it at all. And I had a perfectly pleasant childhood. My family are lovely. I had a very safe childhood. So I don't think there's particular trauma there, but I just wanted to get through it.
But is it? I mean, this is classic ComCom stuff now, because I'm just going to pick you up on two things. One, you knew you were an accident baby.
Yeah.
That's a thing. That's not nothing.
Yeah. My parents had moved on to other things. They had my two brothers, who were 7.5 and 5.5 years older than me. And then my mother's IUD malfunctioned. And here I am, 40 years later.
When did you know that?
I don't know. I feel like I've known since I was really young. But probably before I knew the whole baby process, I knew that I was a mistake baby. But it's sort of a relief in a way. it takes the pressure off.
Dig a bit further into that. How is it a relief? Well, I see what you mean. Because they could never say, hey, listen, we expect more of you than this. Because you could say, you didn't expect anything of me.
Yeah. Or like when families are massive because they've had children all of one sex and they want one of another sex, and you're like, are the middle ones just feeling like filler, and then the one that is of the sex they tried so hard to get, like, what's the pressure on them to behave in a sort of gender stereotypical way? So I didn't have that, but also actually there was pressure, because my older brothers are both very high achieving, and therefore I had to do that. My dad was kind of academically ambitious for us, and I think that's partly an immigrant thing. I think that's common across a lot of immigrants. But I think it was also something... He's not only an immigrant himself, he's the child of an immigrant. So he felt that pressure too, and his response to it was to rebel against it. So he got thrown out of medical school, for instance. Didn't want to be a doctor, but his parents sent him because that's what Jews are supposed to do. So he just didn't go to any lectures and stuff, and he got thrown out. And then he did 3 degrees in maths and stats just so he could piss around at university for 8 years. And then he moved to Britain, so very far away from them, which is also controversial, married a non-Jew, and then became a sculptor. So he just rebelled very hard against every expectation they had for him. And so when it came to us, I remember reading an interview with my brother Andy, where the interviewer was like, what do your parents think about you taking up the profession of comedian? And he was like, when your dad's a sculptor, there's nothing they can do, because every profession seems like a better choice.
Yes.
But it was interesting growing up in that environment, because it was so useful not to have a particular set of professional expectations where only certain jobs would be allowed. It really frees you up to not fear having the kind of feckless piece of shit career path that I had for a really long time. But also just growing up with someone who was very frustrated by the artistic path he chose. I think my dad's a really good sculptor, but he wasn't a marketer. Sculpting is also a profession where, you know, being a successful sculptor is near impossible. And it's like failure is built in, and I think he always felt very bitter.
That's such a but he kind of stood by that choice. That's kind of do you think that there's a nobility to that, like, this isn't working in a kind of, or not that it's not working necessarily, but it isn't going to be explosive, but you're doing the thing for the love of it. Was that like a positive influence on your childhood?
Not really, because I'm not like that at all. I would not have continued podcasting if no one was listening and if the podcast hadn't grown. I don't have that self-motivation in me. My husband will record albums of music because he needs to, not because someone is making him, and I'm not like that. I kind of wish I was. The thing with my dad's choice, like, I admire that day after day he could go to a studio and make a sculpture, and it might take years to finish the piece, because also I like things that are quite quick to make. But I think the problem was the parameters he had for success were very external and not really ones he could control. So I think he would have loved to have been, like, highly feted, have a lot of pieces bought, but be kind of sceney. But if your parameters of success are making these beautiful pieces, you know, following your vision, being really single-minded, then he did succeed, but by his own parameters, he didn't. And that's kind of tragic to me to think about. My mum gave up everything so that he could make it work. And when I was born, he became a sculptor when my oldest brother was a baby, and then my middle brother was in the womb. And by the time I was born, 6-ish years later, he was fairly deep in it. And I think he had set various deadlines for success, but by the time they came around, he was like, well, I'm unemployable now. So all of the times where he should have been like, okay, now I'm going to just try and get a job, he was like, well, there's no point. No one's going to give me a job. And I was just really anxious not to reach that point with my own career, because I was very worried about it. And for over a decade, I did not feel successful, and I was also not earning enough to live. And I was just like, at what point do I call it so that I don't feel like my dad? And I don't inflict these things upon my partner. I don't have children, so there wasn't that fear of, you know, fucking up my family. But I just didn't want to be bitter about what I suppose that the world didn't recognize my brilliance, or that I felt like I'd failed. That was a long answer to whatever your question was. Yes, I was a child once.
Well, I'm interested in whether you, like, your appraisal of that now, that your dad didn't have the, he didn't set his own parameters for success. Like, when did you set your parameters for success? Because I would imagine that you are successful now both by your own parameters and external societal parameters.
That's nice. Is that fair? I mean, I feel very fortunate. I suppose for me, that feeling was when I wasn't thinking about what more I wanted. Like, there are other people in my field who are way more successful than me, and probably other things I could have done if I was more strategic or more business focused or better at marketing, so I'm also not good at that. But feeling happy with the place that I got was not something I ever expected, to the extent that I've had it the last few years. And it's an incredible feeling. Also, not worrying about rent anymore is an incredible feeling. Mm. It's very freeing. But I think the difference that... So while my eldest brother took a more normal career path, and I think that's partly just a reaction to having a father who's a sculptor, and maybe being a bit more aware of the shifting economics, because things were fairly consistent by the time I came along. But I think for him, he would have maybe noticed that things changed faster. They moved a lot before I was born. They moved basically every year, and I think that affected him. But the thing that Andy and I knew about taking a creative path was that we didn't have a fallback option like my dad did. My dad got bailed out by his parents because he was their only child. And I think they just didn't want him or his grandchildren to be completely screwed. So even though they didn't really approve of his career, they still made it possible for him to carry on with it. Andy and I didn't have that financial cushion, so we had to figure out how to make it work. And it was really useful to have Andy as an example a few years ahead of me of a different way to have a creative career.
Yes. Yes, a different way, like a whole different thing again from what you were interested in. Did you have any leanings? Did you ever consider going into comedy as comedy?
Not as stand-up. And I watched a lot of it and thought about it, but it was never something I thought I'd be particularly good at. I mean, I like performing, but it's really only very recently, in the last couple of years, that I've been able to do kind of performance monologues rather than be reactive. And I like not being in front of people. I like that with podcasts, I don't have to leave a room, and nor do they. But also, it's an easier proposition. I feel like I've seen a lot of rough stand-up gigs, and I think it's a brave and confident thing to do, to get up on stage and being like, I think I can make a good use of your time, and I am capable of amusing you. And I don't think I ever felt that confidence. Whereas with podcasts, it's like, here's a thing. You can opt in if you want.
Yes.
But people have paid nothing. They haven't gone to a place with expectations. So it's a bit easier not to disappoint them.
I've got a very clear memory of you and me both appearing on a radio show. I think we were, it was like a topical news thing. It might have been Five Things on some Scottish...
BBC on Scotland. Fred McCauley.
Was it that? On Fred McCauley. Was it Fred? Because I now have a sort of friendship with Fred. And I think at the time I was too wrapped up. I was a newer comic and I was too wrapped up in the fact that I don't write topical jokes. I'm not a big news guy generally. I try and, you know what I mean? I'm not a big news guy. I read the newspaper. But that's the first time I've said the word newspaper in many years. That's interesting. Like,
paper, I follow the news. I remember that
substance. Yeah, I follow the news, but I don't write jokes about it, ever.
Yes,
and
good
I
for
remember
you.
Being really... I remember being like, I'm really nervous and keyed up. I couldn't even remember it was Fred, actually. That's so funny. And then you were the other guest on the show, and I don't think we were in the same... Were we in the same room?
I can't remember. It would have been like one of those little studios with no...
Yes, in Portland. What's it? Portland Place. And you were effortlessly funny about everything, and you had no notes, and you were just riffing on questions and being really funny. And I was desperately trying to remember and find on a piece of paper the bad, ineffective jokes that I've written about the topics I've been given. And I really learned from it. I really went, oh, none of this matters. What matters is listening and having a point of view. Like, you were very riffy funny. I remember being really surprised, going, oh, God, like, I was at no point was I confident, let alone overconfident with that kind of brief. But I do remember thinking, well, I'm glad I'm here with Helen and not someone who's like a pro comic. And then you wiped the floor with me. And I thought, oh, well, there's
it was a contest after all, Stu. That's strange. I think I'm a good value guest on shows like that. I mean, maybe not on your show because I'm not feeling particularly amusing at the moment. But
no, mate, you're giving us absolute pure com-com.
it's a real parade of mirth. I don't know where that comes from. Well, actually, I guess it was just... being the youngest in a household of really funny people. My dad is a very funny man. Both my brothers are really funny. We even had quite a funny dog. And... It was just
what was funny about your dog? I've got to pick you up on that.
She was really sly and she was really greedy. I remember once she stole a box of chocolates, maybe Ferrero Rocher, and just ate them whole and then shat all the foil out.
As a gag.
Well, there's
I'm
a certain
do my great
kind
foil
of
bit now.
Shitty slapstick to it. I remember she stole a kilo of raisins, and then I discovered this because I was sitting at the dining table and my foot found this cold pile of raisin puke.
Oh, God.
She managed to steal a jar of Bovril and get the lid off. That backfired on her because it's too salty for a canine palate. She would try and carry sticks that were wider than the doorway through a doorway, so that was fun. You know, things
absolutely
like that.
Absolutely classic dog slapstick there, the bit yep. with the ladder where you turn round. Oh. Great.
Oh, delightful. But it was that feeling of, again, being at a disadvantage because I was young and my brothers would have all these funny stories about stuff that happened in the day. And I was like, you can't just say you're toddler shit. If you speak, you really have to bring it. And then there was also just that element of survival, I guess, because kids can be cruel without even realizing it. And I was definitely like that too. And I was at somewhat of a disadvantage because I was the youngest in my school year by quite some way. I've always been a fat person, so it's useful having just like ways where people don't bully you. Like I have been very, I mean, it's not nice to say I've been lucky not to be bullied because no one should be, but I haven't. And I think it is partly for being verbally quick. But also just when you're in a kind of guest situation on a comedy show, it's less work because you haven't prepared. And I'm still like that. I don't really think of jokes. And I don't like writing. I really hate it. And I don't know where stuff comes from. I feel like my mind is empty all of the time, pretty much, except for when I'm trying to go to sleep and then it's full of like fear and noisy thoughts that are bad.
Sure. But that's interesting. That's something I hear a lot of compares say in comedy clubs, MCs or hosts or whatever you want to call them, of like what, and I try and do it myself, of walking up to the stage with nothing in your head.
Wow.
So that you can immediately be reactive and play with it. I do that all the time now. It's one of my most fun things if I'm comparing is to like almost to completely disassociate from the environment. Be chatting in the green room as much as possible and getting completely lost in that and then just walk on and go, whoa, here we are, and just kind of dive in like that. So actually to feel like you're like that most of the time is probably quite a good flow state for your creativity, right? Because you're not walking around like a lot of desperate comedians, myself included at certain times, kind of with that clench of going like, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? I have to offer something. Something's required of me. You know, that's a really uncreative place to be for most people. And actually, if you've attained a much more, you know what I mean? Like a sort of an empty vessel state with your mind such that you can riff. I mean that maybe in a very positive way.
Yeah. I think it's very circumstance based. I think I would really shit the bed if I did that, if I was comparing a live show. I think it's great when I'm being reactive and someone else is in control of the medium, but just going on stage with no prep would be alarming. I could think I could do it for a little bit, or if like something stupid happened in the room, like a chair collapse, then like there's always stuff you can do.
You do it. I'd give you half an hour. I'd explain three bullet points, and you'd be able to host a room for the rest of your life because you've got the thing. And actually, the trick of it, I think, is in provoking the audience to do a thing such that you then have something to react with.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's all the same skill sets. You just need to be able to. Oh, you know, there's a million different ways to do it, but I feel like I could see you doing it. Anyway, at the end of this podcast, it's a new format I'm trying. You then immediately walk from your house to host a gig that I've set up.
Okay, cool. Which
nice little finale move.
Oh, God. It's like a reality show, isn't it?
Yeah, if we pull back that piece of art behind you, you will see that 100 socially distant people are standing at 2 meter squares ready for the gig.
But now I understand why so many people have a fear of public speaking.
So this is Helen. We're having a gay old time chatting to each other. What a lovely, warm presence she is. Very, very funny, very professional. She knows what she does inside out. She's really placed herself, not placed herself, that sounds like a more of a plan than perhaps it was, but she has ended up at the centre of the world of podcasting. And it's just lovely to speak to someone who is so passionate about what she does and so naturally funny and so naturally articulate and lucid and all those sort of things. So I'm loving talking to Helen. If you would like to hear more of this episode, there are 25 minutes of extras in which we will talk to Helen about the origins of Answer Me This. We barely mention it here, but we get stuck into a sort of dive into how they cultivated the community of that show, now 14 years deep, how that community passes the show on to their own children. That's incredible. And also some very, very funny stories about early marketing tactics and techniques that are the sorts of things that these days, if you did them, you'd probably already have arranged your TED Talk about them before even doing them. So all of that available to members of the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And hey, I should have read these out at the beginning, but I didn't. These are the current newbie subscribers. Welcome to the team, Alice Bean. Paco Garcia. I tripped over that because that was auto-corrected. I see now to Pace. Pace Garcia. That's the cool Beverly Hills 90210 version of Paco Garcia. Katie Dyer, Christy Trinidad, Jason Roche, Philip Smith, and Pat Cecil. And the winner is Philip Smith, who went in at £10 a month. God love you, Philip Smith. Thank you so much. Remember, you yourself can join the Insiders Club and get hold of all of the extra content by going to comedianscomedian.com/insiders, paying a minimum of £2 a month, but you can upgrade that to whatever you like, but everyone gets the same stuff. So it's like a Clever Clogs Patreon system, which is tiered, except everyone gets the same stuff, and it's all just done on trust, love, and benevolence. There's all of that. The Infinite Sofa, as you well know, and I'm going to make a trailer after I finish recording this, an audio trailer featuring some of the best bits of the interviews with Russell Howard, probably the James Acaster one, who knows, maybe a bit of a Banderman, maybe a bit of Sarah Millican. I'm going to make a short audio trailer to play on the podcast feed. So that should be the next thing you hear on the feed. If you're listening any later than 24 hours after this episode goes out, then bob back on and see if me and Nathan have managed to wham that up just yet. Go to infinitesofa.com, as that trailer will surely tell you. 9 p.m. on Mondays and Thursdays, but you can go to the website anytime, find out who's coming up on the show, and sign up to the mailing list for access to our very swanky virtual green room, which is so much fun after the show for about half an hour or so. Everyone involved in the show or on the mailing list is invited to come and spend some time in a virtual green room that is a little bit like a Zoom room, except you have a little avatar that can walk around so you can peel off and have little breakout conversations. Also, in my life and online, Tuesdays at 8 p.m, chopscomedy.com. Chopscomedy.com, the online home of me, Tony C and David Hawes, Bristol-based new material venture, which opened a few months ago, sold out every show, and then was sadly cancelled and disintegrated in the wake of the Panny D. It's back. It's online. We've had Gary Delaney. We've had Stephen Grant. We've had some fantastic stuff. Kate Lucas was brilliant on it. Nigel Ung last night. Just fabulous. Everyone on there has had a great set and a really fun time. And you can just tell, you can see that sort of enjoyment bubbling over into the room. It uses the same format that I am pioneering for the Infinite Sofa. So there are members of the public in the room, a sort of visible studio audience, if you like. And coming up next week, Tuesday at 8 p.m, Paul F. Taylor, Jared Christmas, Dan Atfield, and Josie Long. So get along to chopscomedy.com. The very last thing I'm plugging for now, and it's plug, 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 I know, but there's a lot going on, and I'd like you all to know about it, is the working lunches. Go to comedianscomedian.com/lunch if you fancy having a little mentoring session with me. Those have been absolutely wonderful so far, and I'm looking forward to doing more. Let's get back to Helen Zaltzman.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah. you're the godmother of podcasting, right?
Yeah.
That, or was it, what do you? What do people say after a comma after your name?
Well, those because you say queen of podcasting, but it's a republic, so yeah. I don't like monarchies.
Pointless queen of.
Yeah, I mean the thing that I like and I'm proud of is that hopefully I gave a lot of information to a lot of people that helped them start or for their shows to get bigger. But I'm happy.
You did. You selflessly, you put yourself out there. You created networks. You very deliberately said, I'm going to give my time to anyone that wants to do this. You could easily have gone, I've had a couple of breaks here. I'll keep that to myself. I'll hoard it and make sure that I don't spill the beans. I'll share the secrets of how to get
on
the front
page. Oh, yeah, so many
secrets
to you. Go to Luxembourg.
Well, simply, I mean, look. I know what you mean,
yeah.
But we're also it is a valid point, right? You like the secret of going to Luxembourg, this is my allusion to a TED talk, was that what you should do is something that's never been done before, that's crafty, that makes people smile, that creates a story, that don't worry about whether the stunt works because the story of the stunt is more important because that's the thing that has legs. You know, all of that, that's a guide to how to get big in whatever. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Find your Luxembourg.
There we go, that's it. Abortive, shit. Unmarketable TED Talk version 2.
Fooled myself. the thing I've always felt with podcasting is there's no secret except for just the graph, just being prepared for it being hard and not fun. And so I always try to tell people that so they don't feel like they've failed when it's not fun and it is hard. But I didn't feel like it was going to make my situation worse by helping other people get started or whatever. Like, why would it?
Do you not think, I mean, I'm just going to press you on that only because I have craven feelings of wanting to pull up the tiny ladder that I have climbed. I try to overcome them and I really make a real effort to honour my podcast mentor and fairy godmother. Oh. But you know what I mean? Like, I like the flavour of the world of podcasting that you introduced me to. That is like, it's about helping each other. It's about letting everyone know how they can do it. Thank God for the Facebook group, podcaster support group, because now I can answer comedians. Well, I know, but from my perspective, comedians regularly get in touch. Not a couple of times a week, but for a while it was a couple of times a week.
Now saying, they've all got podcasts.
Exactly. Yeah, I've used it. Well, people get in touch saying, hey, what should I do? What mic should I get? What should I do? And I could literally fire back, join podcaster support group, spend an entire day reading everything, read a day's worth of stuff.
It's going to be a dull day.
Yeah, it's going to be a horrible day, but then you'll know exactly. And then come back to me, I would say, and ask me specific questions. No one ever returned.
Yeah, hopefully it puts them off. Because, I mean, this is the thing, like, my time was a lot more available before the pod boom, and it was partly because like I make a lot more podcasts now, and so I need more of my time and energy to do the job. But also, just I mean, I also have to recognize that going to Luxembourg might not work for everyone now. Like, the advice I have is not necessarily relevant to today's circumstances. But also, I think the tone of stuff has changed. I think until Serial and the pod boom that followed Serial, you could kind of befriend most podcasters in the world. If you were like, oh, I'm going to be in town and I'm a podcaster and you're a podcaster, and people would be like, great. I've made a lot of pod friends in that way, just because we had podcasts before late 2014. And I think now there's a lot of people where they're quite pyramid schemey about it. So it is not necessarily as sincere an exercise. And
that's so diplomatically put. Yeah. It's not necessarily so sincere an exercise. My God, there's a lot of not necessarilys around.
Yeah, but also just like before there was much reason to do it except for loving to do it, you could meet up with other podcasters and like help them out because you were just like, why not? Like, it felt like a very genuine thing to do. But now people are like, I want to meet you and pick your brain so I can get rich. And I don't really want to participate in that. Well, what I love is when someone genuinely stimulates engagement because they write something with personality, and it can be at heart quite a basic question, but they put it in a way that's very human. But it's the ones where you feel like they've been created in this like entrepreneur bot laboratory just to fuck with people. And that I don't love. Or it's probably not like the best way for them to be either. They probably think, well, I should put on this cloak and it will work, but it won't necessarily work. Like, I think podcast listeners are very, very attuned to insincerity. or pretension, because you're their friend that lives in their brain, and they don't necessarily want to be hectored by someone who does like inspirational fridge magnets, but through their voice.
You mentioned when we started talking that you had recently done the most pretentious thing you've ever done. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, The Illusionist was on a break when the pandemic really hit, and it was good that I didn't have to use my brain to have complex thoughts for a while, because I, like a lot of people, was just spinning out. But
yeah,
I know that a lot of people listen to my podcasts to calm themselves down and get to sleep and things like that, because I think you can often have these disruptive thoughts, and if you listen to music you can still have them, but if you listen to speech it's harder to have your internal monologue. And I thought,
oh, of course.
Yeah. I mean, this is my armchair analysis of it. Yeah. I'm not a scientist.
I'm armchair buying it.
Great. Yeah, it's for sale to armchair dwellers. But through the years, we've heard a lot from people. Like, it amazed us with Answer Me This a few years in, when we would hear from people saying, I listened to you during acute depression or anxiety and things like that. And we were like, this is a reason to carry on even when we don't feel like it. And I never could have foreseen that. And it's one of the most important things to me about podcasting. But with The Illusionist, I was like, I know that the audience wants stuff. I don't really want to have to make proper shows at the moment because I'm on my break and I don't want to have to think. So I did these things that were sort of like ASMR stuff, where it was me soothingly reciting words to serene music that my husband Martin composed. And they're meaningless because the words are detached from meaning. And when
was one of them about? Sorry. Go on. I think I've seen one of these and not understood what it was. Go on.
They're called Tranquillusionists. There's a few of them.
Yes, good. Yes, of course. Yes.
And so the first one, I just got listeners to submit the words they find most soothing, and I just read them out. But then the Celebrity Imagine video came out, and I was going to sleep one night, and I was like, it'd be really funny to do a Tranquillusionist of the song Imagine, but with the words rearranged in reverse alphabetical order.
That's the one I saw, and yeah, I could not tell what the fuck was going on, but it was quite soothing. Like, I wasn't upset. I wasn't at all panicked that I was unable to work out what was happening.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You just swim along with it. And then my husband, he took the chords of Imagine and just alphabeticize them, and he was like, it's great because you've got like 56 bars of F. Just like a minute of F. And I just tried to recite it straight in the most kind of recorded poetry voice that I could muster.
I
think it's really funny, but it was also quite beautiful because you just have this parade of words over lots of F's. And it means nothing.
Where can we find that?
But I tried to make it sound like it meant something.
Is that on The Illusionist? Do you have a YouTube channel?
I made a YouTube just so I could have a video with the words popping up. It's on the podcast feed as well. It's called Midgia, which is the letters of Imagine in alphabetical order. Thank you.
So tell us about The Illusionist then. I remember you asking what you should call it. I love little things like that. Early moments of like, what is that? What is this?
Studying Stuart.
We had a conversation about it some time ago. But I remember you pitching it. I remember it being on Radiotopia. I know that there's some link between Radiotopia and Roman Mars. Is it his network?
When he ran a couple of very, very successful Kickstarters back when that was still unusual in 2012 and 2013. And the 2013 one raised so much by his standards then of being one person with one member of staff. He was like, well, I don't need all this money to run my show. I'll make it possible for other producers I know to run their shows. And he was a big fan of Answer Me This. I'm not sure how he found it. But he wanted Answer Me This to be part of it, except Radiotopia, like the first wave particularly, is these very serious, beautiful sounding shows that are kind of about the human condition, essentially. And Answer Me This is none of those things. But I knew he was interested in working with me. So I just had this thought one day. It was just basically the phrase word detective came into my mind, and I was like, that sounds like it could be a thing. And so I pitched it to him, and he was like, okay, yeah, but not word detective. I think he thought it was just really too obvious.
Yeah, and I think if you're claiming to be a word detective, you need to prove that you can say something wittier than word detective.
Yeah.
Like, otherwise, that's one of those jokes where the joke is the joke itself.
Yeah, although there's something that makes me laugh every time I go by it in my old neighbourhood in Crystal Palace in London, which is a private investigator. It's Finley's Bureau of Investigation. It's FBI. And I just love whatever decision making went into that, where they were like, well, just because there's another FBI doesn't mean I don't have the right to it.
Yeah.
And then they've got like some funny URL where it's like fbi.uk.ltd.com. But anyway, he was right, because also, well, someone else has used word detective now anyway. It's funny, they're like all these names we came up with for Answer Me This before we came up with Answer Me This that we rejected then for being too shit and too cheesy. A lot of them were pod puns. And now all of them fucking exist. Like the BBC is like popping out these early rejected Answer Me This names. And I was like, seriously, try harder.
What were some of the other front runners before you settled on The Illusionist? Which is perfect, incidentally.
Thank you, Stuart. It means a lot to me that you say that, because it was a tricky choice. It was weeks of like back and forth arguing with the people behind the scenes at Radiotopia and Roman. They all wanted something that was like very kind of artistic sounding, and I wanted something. I found it very hard to take myself seriously at the time, not like now. And I wanted something that I could say without laughing at myself.
Yes.
So when they were coming up with stuff like idiomatique, I was like, I can't do it. I can't do it. Or they would come up with things that were very dry. Or loads of people wanted it to be called More Than Words, like the Extreme song. And I was like, you know, the Extreme song is a bit gross when you think about it lyrically. And also there are already shows called that, which is another thing that podcasters need to do. You need to research that there are not other podcasts of the same name.
Yes.
And we were really desperate because they needed to launch the thing. And I remember I was in a like an audio workshop run by two of the other Radiotopians, and I was just sitting in the back and I wasn't really paying attention because I was desperately trying to think of a fucking name for the show, and Roman was also there and I was texting him because I couldn't talk, and I was texting him these names and he was like, no, and I was like just flicking through the Thesaurus app, which is a very useful app.
Love it.
And I don't know what I put in it, maybe something like Subtext, which was another high potential name that I'm glad it isn't called. And Illusion came up and I was like, The Illusionist, and I texted it to Roman and he was like, yes, and then he was like, no, the vowel's going to be a problem when you say it aloud. So then we had like a few more weeks of just these like fucking names, and I was like, it's got to be The Illusionist, and the funny thing is just explaining the vowel.
Yeah,
and that's what it is.
Excellent.
Yeah,
it is. When you find something like that, I have a new podcast coming out with Sindhu V, and it's a parenting podcast, and it's called Child Labour. And I know, right? But everyone I say it to laughs out loud. But it was one of those ideas where we were in a pub in near Angel, and I said to Sindhu, I mean, we could call it, like, not this, but something like Child Labour. And she went, no, that's really good. And I said, yeah, but we can't call it that. And she went, it'll offend people. It conjures the idea of actual child labour. And she's like, Stuart, my temptation is always to do an impression of Sindhu, but I won't. but she said, Stuart, if those kind of people that think that's a problem, I don't want them listening to my fucking podcast. And I'm like, yes, that's the way to do it. But we really ummed and ahed for a long time because, like, is it the right thing? But everyone you say it to, it's a quirk of the thing, and you go, yep. You know, it's one of those ideas. You have the idea, it exists in the world, and you can't let go of it.
Is the problem with that if you type it into Google, it's going to come up with thousands of pages of things about how children are mistreated in
the show
countries?
Will be called Child Labour with Stuart Goldsmith and Sindhu V. So if you type all of that into Google.
Yeah, fair.
We've done our best.
Thanks. I often feel like I'm doing things just to minimise people's opportunities to whine about them to me.
Yes. Well, I'm going to hide behind Sindhu because she's a alpha lady who I can just go, oh, that's a Sindhu decision, but goodbye.
It sounds like she's kind of excited and ready for the whiners.
Yeah, I think so. She's very, she's pretty tough. She'll give them a tight slap, in her words. The running joke on the show, we've pre-recorded 9, we haven't released them yet. They go out in about 3 or 4 weeks. They start going out, and we've recorded a bunch. And the running joke of the show is that I regard her as bad cop, and she insists that she isn't bad cop very forcefully. So we'll see. Tell me, when it comes to The Illusionist. Your production values are second to none. The
That's research nice of you to say. It doesn't feel it, like that.
No, it's true. It's true. The sound quality is brilliant. It just feels like, you know, you get Prestige TV. I feel like The Illusionist is a Prestige podcast.
Oh, thank you, Stuart. Thank you.
No, but do you know what I mean? I think it is because the content is brilliant and it's focused and deeply researched and thought about and the quality of the whole thing is great and the name is great and everything else. And I feel like it sort of, it really makes sense that it's your vehicle now, I guess your primary vehicle for being in the world and being the person. I forget the name of the award you won, but was it last year you won most key person in podcasting ever or something? British Podcast Award? I don't remember the name.
Podcast champion,
something like that.
Whatever that means.
Whatever that means. But
like
that's
a show
it.
Jumping podcaster.
I won Best International Guest at the New Zealand Comedy Festival.
Wow.
And it was completely ruined for me by someone saying, that suggests you left the place really tidy when you left. It's like, ooh, best guest.
Oh, but that is a nice accolade when someone's like, you were a good guest in my home.
Yeah, that's nice. It's nice.
Yeah, and I feel like in New Zealand, being a good guest there is particularly important.
100%. I goddamn love that place.
Missing it.
So
I was there just like a year ago, and today Facebook memories told me that this time last year, I was at a prawn park in New Zealand.
Oh man. Facebook Poor memories are a killer during the Pandy Day. They are tough. Tell me though, with regard to The Illusionist, it feels like one of those things that has always existed. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue. Do you know what I mean? It feels like just a thing. No, I don't mean that's a bad example because that obviously has existed for a very long time. But it feels like it's one of those ideas that you've kind of cracked and gone, there we go. That's what that is. Do you know what I mean? It feels timeless.
Yeah, maybe that's coming back to what you were saying earlier about how do you know when you're successful? And I guess what I have at the moment is a show where I do want to do other things in my life and develop different skills and use different muscles. But fundamentally, what the show is and what I can do with it feel limitless at the moment. They're only limited by my ability to do them and have interesting thoughts and also just like not collapse, because it is quite... Most shows like The Illusionist would have at least four people working on them rather than one.
Yeah.
So that's a thing. But it feels like, you know, when I started, people assumed ridiculous things to me, that it's niche. And language, it's about language. Language is a tool that everyone uses, everyone. I was never really taught anything about it. And we should. We're using it all the time, and it's so complex. And there are so many ways in which it can go wrong. And also, it's changing all the time. So that's another big deal. We have to keep on top of the developments and just be really aware of how we're using it and other people are. There's so much in that. It's really, really difficult. And then the English language is an enormous language. There's like 400,000 plus words. It's actually quite difficult to count because do you count different parts of speech, blah, blah, blah. But like, that's roughly the number. It's bigger than most languages. And yet I was taught fuck all about it and how to use it and what it means and the history of it as well. Like, English is problematic too. Like, the things that a particular dialect of English, like standard English, is not actually a standard. It's just a variation that has privilege behind it. Yep. And so it has exerted its power over a lot of other things and thus wiped out a lot of variety or wiped out other languages or other cultures. You know, the story of English as well is also the story of like the empire and colonialization and a lot of bleak shit that has really fucked the world. But at its very basic level, it's just like the words that come out of our mouths and reach someone else's ears. Right.
Yeah.
Or on the page, and the resonance those have. So there's kind of infinite things I could do with it. But also it's meant to be an entertainment show. And it's meant to be useful for people so that they've got a couple of facts at their disposal if they need some facts to drop into a difficult chat or something. But at the beginning, people were like, oh, it's niche. And also language is boring because language shows are often just either someone quite posh going, did you know, blah, 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 used to mean a fruit tree and blah, 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 or you're using commas incorrectly. And I also don't want to do that. I mean, I was a real pedant before I started the show, and that really tailed off fairly quickly when I realised through working on it that it's actually an unsustainable way to be, and it is preferable to get rid of all that pointless anger. But so on the surface, it's like a bit of fun, bit of distraction, educational, but not in too spoon-feedy a way, because I find that condescending and I don't like it myself. But what it's supposed to be doing secretly is just rewiring your brain. Yeah. Like, it's supposed to change the way that you think about language and communication and what that means about other people as well. Like, I think when the show really works, it's just someone going, oh, fuck, well, now I can never use this word in the same way again. Shit, what have you done? Like, I've ruined namaste for a lot of yoga teachers, apparently.
Oh, why is that? How did you ruin namaste?
Oh, because, I mean, a lot of people in, I suppose, Western appropriated yoga, Westernized yoga, will use namaste in ways that it doesn't actually mean. What it is a formal hello.
Gotcha.
So when you say it like very solemnly at the end of class as if it's a prayer, it's not. It's a formal hello.
Okay.
And it was an Indian-American friend who put me onto it, Rishi Hirway, who makes the podcast Song Exploder, amongst many others, because it really pisses him off.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's actually stopped me going to certain yoga classes. And then the yoga teacher's like, what am I supposed to say at the end of the yoga now?
Cheers.
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly.
And that's yoga. Yeah.
But like, it's amazing for me to get to educate myself as well. Like, the interest for me is finding out things that I didn't know. Like, I'm not that interested in telling people what I know because my brain feels empty, as aforementioned. And one particularly amazing thing is the ways that the listeners will share their thoughts with me, and some of those like really kind of go very deep. So there's a lot of trans people that listen to the show, and I did this episode a few years ago about the inadequacy of the vocabulary for your genitals.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem is that word is like, it's about reproduction, the word genitals. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the terms we have for them, like slang and technical, are sexual or for procreation. But what if you're not using those organs for those, or you don't want to use words that are gendered because they're triggering for you or whatever? So a lot of trans people got in touch after that episode going, these are the problems I have, for instance, when I go to the doctor and I have to describe something, but the words that I have to do it are damaging to me to use. And yes, I was like, geez, could you record yourself talking about that? And they did. And it was like super fascinating, really interesting. And I was very reluctant to put out the episode. I never would have asked for it, because trans people are often reduced to their bodies anyway, and particularly sure, to those parts of their bodies. But them saying, here is how I navigate the world and how words work for me. And it felt like so personal, but also just like opening the door to like this massive universe that was right there. And you never gave it a thought if you're cis. So things like that, just like, I'm so lucky that people will share this stuff with me and that I have a platform to share it with other people.
What do you want next?
That's always been a difficult question. I've never been much of a forward planner beyond a couple of weeks. And particularly now, where it feels like time is it's on pause, but it's not really. I've spent a lot of the last few years feeling like on the brink of a physical and mental shutdown. And in fact, it came pretty close with like the whole hospitalization thing. And so I want to feel like if I'm not going to be able to make the show or make as much show just through my own limitations as a human being, that I want to do some incredible stuff with it and really, really do things that I find beyond my capabilities while I still have the opportunity and while still people are listening. So I'm always expecting the whole thing to fall apart as well, that like the financing will disappear and the audience won't give a shit anymore. And then I'll have to get a job. Although I am probably unemployable now, more unemployable than my dad. At least he knows how to what cut do trees do? Down and mend
I'm
walls.
I'm an audio sculptor. The audio only thing sculptor. More pointless than a sculptor.
I don't know. There's a market for it at the moment. What do I want? What do I want? What do I want, Stuart? That's a great question that I'm asking myself a lot.
What would you do if you were financially independent, like completely independent, like you fall over 10 billion quid and you go, oh, that's you're allowed to have it. What would you do?
Oh, You know what? I would do fuck all. That's the problem. Like, if I didn't have to work, answer. I'd be like, well, okay, I'll do it tomorrow. And then I just wouldn't. Like, I'm motivated by the necessity and by sponsors having, like, bought a particular ad 6 months in advance that they need it done by this date. They need a show to come out with that ad on it on this day. That's why I get things done. It's so unromantic and it sounds so uncreative. I feel like so many of my creative decisions are motivated by the most boring practical shit.
Yeah, I remember my friend Hutch years ago, we were having a conversation about what would you do if you had $1 million, and he gave me a long detailed answer and he said, and what about you? And literally before I could control it, the first words out of my mouth were, well, the problem with that is, and he was like, shut up. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's already told us everything we need to know about your personality.
Yeah. I would have to give a lot of it away and then make myself need things. Because I don't really want money except for not having to worry about money. Like, the acquisition of money is not that interesting to me. So then what is? Jesus, you've really exposed a weakness at the heart of my whole system.
No, not a weakness, like, a vulnerability, and that's why you're brilliant.
Yeah. We were just touring with The Illusionist for the last 2 years, which was amazing. And I loved that. So it's like, how do you find a way to kind of keep going around the world with this show, getting to have this like fun time with the people that like the show? So it's a very easy gig turning up to a live podcast gig, because they're all opted in already and they're just pleased to see you.
I wish that my podcast worked for a live audience. It does, but it's so guest dependent. It isn't its own thing. I can't tour it just me. So I can't, you know, I can't do exactly what you're describing, and I'm green and seething with jealousy. It looks so much fun. People are already up for it. They want to see what you've got. And you just go and do the thing live. Ah, that's miraculous. And kids. I love my kids, but they're a ball ache when it comes to international travel.
I mean, you get like the love for your children, and hopefully they'll look after you when you're old and all of that. And I get to go and do some really fun gigs in Minneapolis, which is a great place to gig if ever the opportunity arises. And also some very interesting mini golf. But with The Illusionist, it doesn't really work on stage either. But so I wrote basically like an hour of stand-up about gender and language.
Maybe I'm trying to solve the wrong problem here. I need to write an hour of stand-up about stand-up and tour that as the
work great
show.
For Hannah Gadsby.
Yeah. I'm reminded now of the fact that a comedian who I won't name planned 2 years ago, the year after the Nanette year, to call their Edinburgh show Nanette 2. Which is one of the funniest ideas I think I've ever heard.
That's a really good joke. It's an expensive joke. I respect it.
It is a very expensive joke. And it's not just expensive. It also costs quite a lot.
But with you, it's tricky because you're taking a live art, making it into podcasts. And then how do you turn that back into a live art?
Yeah.
What a curious problem to have.
It's got to be possible. It's a fun challenge. And hey, it's not one that need occupy me for a year or so. Because I'm pleased to say the most recent time that you mentioned the current climate, the pandemic, whatever we're calling it, I realised that I had forgotten all about it for the last hour whilst having this lovely conversation.
I mean, my job is like it's largely unaffected by this because I'm indoors on my own recording down the line with people anyway. I don't interact with people face to face very often at all. It's embarrassing, really, how little it has changed. But I wonder whether what you could do is almost like a kind of inspirational leadership thing where you're like, how to be funny from the greatest people in the biz. And it's like you and an hour and a half and clips.
Yeah, I do. I sort of do a corporate thing, which is broadly along those lines. But I'd like to do like a fan fun. I mean, I do get to do my own stand up, but I feel like much as I'm loving the stand up and they're having a great time too, I feel like I'd sell more tickets if I was doing the ComCom show. Somehow.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
Think you're right. I think because people's expectations, again, they're like, I'm going along because I already love this thing. Not, I'm going along because this person's a comedian and they will amuse me, damn it, or I want my money back.
It's a different thing, exactly. I'm not getting to revel in that thing that you are, which is, hey, they've opted into specifically what this thing is. But enough about me.
Also, a lot of people have been to some shit live podcast shows where they were less good than listening at home. So I think they weren't expecting me to have written a show that worked on the stage. They were just going out of goodwill. So it was nice to pleasantly surprise them.
So that is effectively a piece of stand-up comedy. So how did you write it?
Oh, God, it was really bad. I mean, I had the idea for it quite a long time before, but I don't get anything done until the deadline is right there. And I did SF Sketchfest in 2018 and 2019. And it was partly a challenge because I'd done these other people's live shows, like being a guest on them, like The Bugle. And I'd done this two-hander in 2017 with Roman Mars, 99% Illusional, which is like a combination of our podcast. Oh, nice. It was really funny. There was like an unexpected song at the end, like some fun little like fake outs and stuff, but he doesn't do a lot of live stuff. And, I was like, I've got to learn to do this by myself. And so I booked this SF stand up, SF Sketchfest show. And I was like, okay, you've got to learn it. And, the sort of performance breakthrough thing, this is the 2018 show, it's not even the Hour of Stand-Up About Gender and Language, because this is the show that led to the Hour of Stand-Up About Gender and Language. The thing I wrote for that was that it was like a show in four parts, so like four different chapters. It was easy because it was just, you know, only had to be 15 minutes and then it was another thing. Yeah. I wrote this like prose song about typing champions of history. And it's called WPM. It's now out on the free feed. But that to me was like a breakthrough piece of writing. And I wrote that basically on the morning that we had the SF Sketchfest gig.
Amazing.
And then like we toured that show on and off throughout that year. And at some point on the tour, I was like, I really want to write this thing about gender and language, but I don't have time now because I'm on a tour. But I do have SF Sketchfest like a few weeks after the tour ends. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, well, I'll take some time off over Christmas and write it. Didn't. You know, I'd also been like very ill. I'd been hospitalized for 3 weeks that year, got home for Christmas off the tour, still like recovering from the shit that I'd had. And then my mum got hospitalized and I had to go home and look after my dad, who has advanced Parkinson's. So it's like, okay, you can probably forgive yourself for like not writing a thing, but like in January you should definitely do it. And then like didn't. And then it was like, it was literally the day before the show and I was like, you've got to write a fucking hour about gender and language. And I was staying at a friend's house and I was just like sitting in their living room, just like bashing this thing out, like in this fugue. And I managed it, and the show was, I mean, there's a lot of facts in it. So like, it's interesting, even if it's like not necessarily that well crafted.
Yeah.
But it's so shameful that this is the way I work. And I think it's partly so that the pressure of having to get it done means it comes out right or almost right the first time.
Yeah.
And then I was like, God, well, that was painful. And also I kind of hated it. The next show is not till, not for like another 3 months. So you'll spend that 3 months like shaping it. Didn't, a fucking course.
Yeah.
Got to New Zealand to start touring it there. And so like then we started to shape it because then we were touring New Zealand and Australia and then the US. So it did develop, but like fundamentally it's still like 70% what it was.
That's incredible. That I bashed out in that fucking day. I love the idea of that. So given that that worked, has it occurred to you to try to do that next time when you're writing another show?
God.
To go, I'm going to do nothing until the day or the day before, because that creative crisis actually produced a show which is now 70% visible.
But it's bad because my husband does the music in the live shows and he's like, I could use more than a couple of hours to compose all this music, please. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
You would think that would motivate me. I also have to do visuals and sometimes order artwork from people. It'd be nice to do that before the show began rather than like halfway through a tour. And just also having some ingenuity. And the thing I'm pleased with the gender show was I made a costume for it that was a prop in the show as well. It was like this black sequin dress that I could write things in. And then partway through the show, I wiped those things off. At a dramatic moment, and people are like, how has she done that?
Very good.
So, like, I had enough foresight to have done that. It would be nice to do more kind of stagecrafty things with it and not just be kind of, you know, only 7 out of 10 happy with a piece.
Yes. Well, what you need is you need a one-off show that you can write on the day, and then you've done that show, and then you've got a month until your next gig where you can do the clever... this is not a problem that you come to me with. This is unsolicited advice.
We're just repeating what has happened the previous 2 years. I mean, now technically I've got a year, you know, who knows how long, infinity time until I next perform again. And I've got some ideas that are tickling my brain, but I was like, it's not their time. I have a very short queue of concern and I can do the next thing in the queue, and the queue doesn't stretch that far back. So I was like, oh, you should write a book while The Illusionist is off air during this break you've got for like 3 months. Have I written a book? Have I fuck?
Helen, this is all we've got time for. My son is now bouncing up and down on the bed, and to be fair to him, I did promise him, and I'm 5 minutes late, which is a shame because I could talk to you for a lot longer. Thank you so much for joining me. Your podcast is The Illusionist, and what other things, well, there's Answer Me This, of course, the granddaddy of all the podcasts. What other things, to where should you direct us?
Oh, I have another podcast as well called Veronica Mars Investigations, which is recapping the TV show Veronica Mars. And if you don't watch that, we just did an episode recapping the 1995 BBC miniseries of Pride and Prejudice.
Get recapping. You have a central point website that we could point people at?
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit neglected, but helenzaltzman.com is one.
Okay, well, Twitter. Maybe we'll get on your contact page at helenzaltzman.com and send you...
I may have taken the contact page down so you can't emails. Send me your linguistic complaints.
So that was Helen. Thank you so much to Helen for coming along. That was a joy of a conversation. Thank you to everyone that tuned in at twitch.tv/Stu Goldsmith to see us record that conversation live. Thanks to Callum Morin for helping me sort that out. He's producing my Twitch stuff. Thanks to Nathan Wood for producing this episode. Jake Crossland for logging it. Your podcast consultant is Pete Dobbing, and the music was by Rob Smouten. That was Helen. You can find out what Helen's doing. Just search for Answer Me This or more sort of shiny and new, and Helen's solo project, The Illusionist. You can find that on the Radiotopia Network, wherever you get your podcasts. The Illusionist is so fun. And have a listen. Have a little squiz online at the YouTube version of The Tranquillusionist that she was talking about just there. That's really fun. And it's bonkers, and it was fun to find out what it actually is. So do visit or revisit that. Remember to go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for 25 minutes of extra content from Helen and bags of other stuff, as well as access to the Slack workspace, infinitesofa.com for all of your online chat show requirements. And do just bob your head in at 9 o'clock on a Monday and Thursday and see what we're doing. I'm so, so proud of it. Seeing Rob Broderick improvise a freestyle rap with multiple sound effects, sound pads and cues and stuff about me and Sarah Millican as we were chatting, and the fact that we were all in the So You Think You're Funny final back in 2005 together. I just, honestly, if you go back and watch it, you can see them all at infinitesofa.com, the previous episodes. I'm just crying laughing with my head in my hands. It was so magical. So go and do that. And finally, I will post Amble at you after the episode concludes now. Oh, so, gosh, talking, lots and lots of internet talking for me. And here's a quick thing that happened to me, and I just wanted to share it with you because it was so weird. I was in a little branch of Tesco, not the one I normally go to. It was near us, and I just normally, it's like turn left up the hill or turn right down the hill. Well, I happened to turn left up the hill and went to this other branch, and they do things very differently there. Because it's a small branch attached to a garage, I guess that's probably why, they have to hoof people round it at great speed. I didn't realise it's all one way, but it's so close that you can't walk past each other. And there's nobody at the front saying, hey, this is one way, so everyone be really quick. And you know what I mean? Just follow that track once. That none of that was explained. And I'm trying not to be difficult. I had this thing whereby it was unfamiliar to me. I had to buy some ingredients. I didn't know where they were. So I was dawdling, right? I was looking at the thing, not realising, of course, that behind me... I mean, I don't even think anyone was racking up behind me. But I do respect that the staff were keen to make their system work without having necessarily articulated it to the understanding of someone who, to be fair to them... was probably kind of not expecting to be completely cocking up the system and also dithering with a glove with one of those little contact touchy things on the fingertip trying to look at my list on my phone. And I dawdled, and then I got sort of told off for dawdling. They said, can you hurry up? And I was like, sure. All I needed to say was, oh, I'm going as fast as I can. Am I getting the system wrong? But I sort of felt a bit kind of a bit tilted. I felt a bit like, what have I done? What? And then I said, well, I can go round again, though, can I? Thinking if there's someone behind me, I can just go, I'll go round this load of shelves again, do a little double loop, and then I can come back to the bit I was looking at whilst letting the person behind me get on with it. And the lady said yes. So I did that, and then a different guy came out and said, and bless him, he said, can I have a polite word? Which is often sort of the thing that comes before a not very polite word. He was polite about it, but then he said, you can't keep going round. And I said, she just told me I can. And he said, I've been watching you. You keep going round these. I said, I genuinely haven't. I've done it once. And then I can't remember what he said next, but I kind of panicked. And my job is to be articulate and fluent with conversations in public. And it's my job because I love it and I'm good at it. And it all left me. It all left me. And I stood there and I think I said, I don't know what you mean, but I'm hurried up. I said, I don't understand what you mean, but I'm happy to hurry up. And so I just panicked and kind of ran around the rest of the aisles and finished my shop and got the fuck out of there. And then, of course, they had those big screens at the Panini screens at the checkout. So I kind of went up and put my bag for, you know, the shopping bag that I'd brought, my bag for life. And as I did that, the person behind the counter drew back quickly. And I was like, oh, God, I didn't mean to startle you. Fuck, this is going tits up. I was probably a breath away from just one of those moments when you just throw everything down and run out of the shop. I'm out. I can't do it. I nearly had one of them. I went and sat in the car. I fucked up the pretty complex glove system that you've got to do where you do that glove has now touched the key. So now the key's got virus all over it because the gloves have touched all the shopping that's been put there and touched by who knows who. So now I've took one glove off to open the car door, and now I've picked up the key, and now I've got the non-gloved hand is potentially virus as well. All of that faff. Sat in the car, thought, am I going to have a cry? Am I going to have a cry in the car? I'm feeling very jumpy, and I remember thinking, am I agoraphobic now? Am I spending so much time at home that I am unable to deal with the outside world? Because I just had that kind of, fuck, get home before you have a panic attack or a cry. And I thought, I can't go and have a panic attack and a cry at home. I don't want to drive feeling panicky, but I don't want to stay here. And nor do I want to go home and, you know, I don't have a problem with crying in front of my children, but I don't want to have a panic attack, cortisol dump, depression, cry in front of my kids. That's still a thing I sneak away and do in private. And rightly so. It is the right of every Englishman to have a private cry. So I kind of just tried to kind of calm down and then drove home very carefully in that kind of a... Do you know, this is a PSA. That's public service announcement in the States. I don't know what we call it here. Announcement. That's what we call it. This is an announcement. After you have a near miss when you're driving, immediately stop and or calm yourself down and be extra alert because accidents often happen. I seem to recall from some course or other. Must have been a speed awareness course, but it wasn't karate, was it? Accidents often happen just after a near miss because you're jittery. In the same way that like long motorway drives tend to be fairly safe, lots of accidents happen just when you're leaving home and just when you're getting home after a long drive. Similar thing. So I was on sort of high tension and high alert. So I drove safely home and then sat in the car and had a bit of a bubble. And that means a cry. I don't know if anyone says a bit of a bubble. A bit of a cry. And it doesn't mean it's not vaping or anything. A bit of a bubble. And a couple of hits from my enormous bong. Just sort of had a bit of a healthy cry and then went in and just got on with my life. But God... really horrible and really unnerving for someone, as I say, who like, I'm supposed to be able to do this. So I just thought I'd share that in case you... I haven't heard the recent Ellis and John podcast, but my wife pointed out that Ellis had something similar happen to him too, getting told off for playing outside with his kid. And I'm not saying that the staff... I've not got no complaint with the staff at all. I'm not saying that they were small-minded or difficult, simply that I didn't understand the difference in system in that branch compared to the one I would ordinarily go to. And so it's not a rant about like, you know, people are pointing fingers so much as it's me going, oh, sorry, unnamed Tesco staff member, sorry I fucked up, sorry I couldn't explain that I was fucking it up, sorry that I went all wobbly and ran away. And I suppose I'm just kind of sharing it to get it off my chest and say, you know, if you're experiencing this sort of thing as well, hey, don't worry. Even someone as psychologically robust as me, I mean, I don't know if you can tell how ironic I'm being. I'm a fucking bag of wet lettuce mentally at the best of times. So I'm not even saying that. I'm not even saying, hey, guys, it could even happen to me. I'm saying, oh, God, I suppose we're all in this together. Fuck, go and have a little cry in your car if you need one. There, that'll do. There we go. That's absolutely classic Goldsmith content. Coming up next week on the episode with Brett Goldstein, Brett is someone who's listened to every single episode of this podcast, as a result, has listened to every single postamble, and also knows me and knows way more about my internal life than I do about his. So hello, Brett, and I'm sorry that you felt by calling it a non-com pod, I tricked you into doing a regular com-com. That is sort of what happened, but it was an unconscious, it wasn't a decision on my part. It wasn't guile so much as my inability to just be myself. It's a cracker of an episode, mate. You've got nothing to worry about. I wonder if you will listen to your own episode. Who knows? Thanks for listening, you. You, not Brett. Well, you, Brett, as well, but you, everyone else. Cracker of an episode next week and some more excellent stuff coming your way besides. Bye for now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.